current state, mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up on Tuesday's program here, we explore proposed new regulations involving hydraulic fracturing here in Michigan, fracking. Those are from the DEQ. We'll check in with the Michigan Environmental Council's James Clift to get his assessment of those proposals, and how a couple of Okemos business owners have helped runners all around the world prevent injuries. The story of good form running with playmakers Kurt Munson and John Benedict. That is later this hour. At the top of our program, it has become clearer how Lansing's publicly owned utility, the Board of Water and Light, failed its customers following last December's ice storm. A detailed review by an investigative panel headed by one of our next guests explores the utility's actions before, during, and after the storm that knocked out power to some 35,000 customers. It details faulty policies, a lack of sound policies, and failures to execute. Panel Chairman General Michael McDaniel calls the utility's lack of record-keeping mind-boggling. It broadly addresses BWL senior leadership, but it leaves the fate of BWL General Manager Peter Lark to city officials and to the BWL board to determine. To learn more, we turn to two guests. General Michael McDaniel has been the chairman of Lansing's Community Review Team. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And we also welcome Darnell Early, a member of the CRT for the past 4 months, a Lansing resident, the current emergency financial manager for the city of Flint, and the former city manager of Saginaw. Thanks for being with us, Darnell.
Thank you for having me.
What is in this 75-page report that really stands out right away for you, General McDaniel?
Well, I think the big picture sort of issue that I think that the BWL missed is their role in the community. Everything that we see in their outage report, everything we've seen since the ice storm itself, has focused only on the outages, just even referring to it as an outage report. And really, they're not perceiving themselves correctly as a vital part of our community. They provide electric power and water, the two most vital systems that we need for our community, and they have to be more integrated within the regional community, not just looking at outages.
Darnell Early, what about you? 75 pages, a lot of information, a lot of recommendations here. What rises to the top for you?
Well, it was pretty obvious to me that the response was mediocre at best, and I don't say that accusing anyone or in any way suggesting that they weren't up to the challenge. What I am saying is that these kind of events will test any system, obviously. And if you haven't had an opportunity to, you know, to train on an ongoing basis, to communicate on an ongoing basis, to advise the public of what you're going to do should something like this happen, all of a sudden it hits you, and then it creates a situation like we had. And by the way, I'm a Delta Township resident as representative of the committee. And in the township, obviously, we are not a part of the governance, but there were some issues that I think we discovered that maybe would make the city of Lansing and the board want to take a look at the broader picture of how to arrive at a better place as a result of this incident.
A defective outage management system, or OMS, played a critical role in the Board of Water and Light's uncoordinated response. General McDaniel, tell us first what a functioning OMS should do.
The OMS system does two things, really. It is connected to, or it should be connected to, the electrical management system, so that, like the electrical management system, those two can talk to each other and they can know exactly where we have power and where we do not. Because its then most important role is sort of as a predictive system, so that it assists not just in the compilation of all the data of where there are outages from various sources, including from their customer service reps, from their own website, and from information which is inputted by the damage assessors and spotters that are out there, but then it does some predictions as to where outage restoration should begin. So it assists in the prioritization of restoration itself. So it's a very important system in terms of saying, okay, here's the scope of the outage that we have, here's where we're going to focus first, and then it gives them the ability to track their progress.
And is it known, did you learn in this process why the BWL's OMS system was not functioning properly?
Well, the immediate reason was the lack of its ability to recognize what are called conductor cuts. I mean, when you are going in to restore power, first you have to assure the safety of the line workers, so you have to cut the power to that system. This was not sensed by the system. This was not something it could recognize. So it was, in essence, saying power was back on when power wasn't on those areas. You know, you had over 400 lines that had to be addressed. It had an inability to recognize that. As a result of that, they had to scrap the system, at least temporarily, put the system aside and do this by hand, by using paper information coming in, and then sort of compiling that. The reason why that would be a problem, obviously, is, well, everything that has come in thus far from their own damage assessments, everybody who was called in, all that information is lost, and in essence, they then have to start over. And it's going to take much, much longer because now you're doing it by paper, and now you're trying to go back and reconstruct. And customers were not aware of the fact that the information that they had already provided on their damage had been lost when the OMS system had to be scrapped temporarily.
You go out of your way on page 46, it seems, to note in italics that there were gaps in the information as to why it took so long to get the OMS operational. There were flaws in the system. There was a dispute with General Electric, the systems maker. There were delays. Can you expand on that?
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, an event like we had in December will test even the best of systems. And I think that a number of things that needed to be in place that you would expect if the system had been tested regularly or had there been enough time spent to make sure that everything would work in the event of such an event or situation just simply wasn't done. And so,
but there were real hang-ups implementing the system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a part of that, again, is just due to the fact, in my opinion, from the data that we reviewed, was that in most cases, those situations were things that they just weren't prepared to do.
I think one of the problems I had with the OMS was that they switched from their old system to this new system from General Electric without any backup in place. Now, certainly you can say that for a small publicly owned utility, having an entire redundant system would have been too expensive. But there could have been some means of doing backup of data. Especially when you're testing a new system like this. So they put the new system in place without adequate safeguards. They have told us that they have stress tested the system since, but from our conversations with them, they have not tested the system at maximum capability, and they haven't tested it under other types of outages to think about what other events might cause the system to all of a sudden get a huge spike in customer calls and other forms of data coming in.
And the paper system that they had to revert to became the source of a pretty serious bottleneck.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, not only that, but it was outdated technologically in terms of their capacity to get the most information that they could and, you know, react as needed given the circumstances.
And the Board of Water and Light came back to you at some point, I gather, and said that even if the OMS had worked, it would not have made a great deal of difference?
They asserted that originally, but as we talked with them, I think if there wasn't an outright concession, it was pretty close to an outright concession that there was a couple of days lost. Obviously, there has to have been, because you lose all the information that you had in the OMS. You have to start over and reconstruct where you have the outages using a paper system, which was converted to, you know, a spreadsheet on a standalone laptop. Clearly, you have lost a certain amount of time. In our estimation, they lost 2 to 3 days.
Our guest here today on Current, State General Michael McDaniel, chairman of the Community Review Team, reviewing the performance and the response of the Lansing Board of Water and Light to last December's ice storm, also a member of that Community Review Team, the emergency financial manager for the city of Flint, Darnell Early. The report sharply criticizes the utility over its lack of record keeping. Yesterday, you called it mind-boggling. What made it so bad?
As having been in some form of government my entire career, having been in Homeland Security, having been in military, you have to document your own performance. You have to keep a log. The city of Lansing emergency managers did the same, did keep a very close log in their emergency operations center of every action that was taken, of every conversation that occurred. By contrast, we have nothing. Nothing whatsoever from the Board of Water and Light during this period of time. How can you say that you are going to learn from your mistakes and go forward if you have not documented what your performance was? It is a basic report card. It has to be based upon some information. That information is utterly lacking.
I'll quote from the report here. Their policy requires disposal immediately after use, referring here to emails. A policy of non-distribution of any records it deems sensitive information, end quote. No communication records with municipalities during emergencies. Such policies almost seem designed to hamper communication.
Well, I would certainly question such a policy. I've spent 35 years of my life in the public sector as a public administrator, and we're in a fishbowl as it comes to information, communications. We have to provide the documentations under freedom of information and some other things. I would question the validity of such a claim, given the fact that you have many municipalities who have many of our residents within those municipalities, who lead those municipalities, and to somehow or another say it's not important to communicate with those individuals, particularly in a case such as this, just underscores, you know, my assessment as a member of the team that the response overall was mediocre at best. And I would also point out that it's important for people to understand that we poured over thousands of pages of documents that were provided in order to gain some consensus on the response and the ability of the utility to recover and to restore services. And because of the things that we've talked about and that are in the report that suggest that they didn't come together in a fashion that I would have expected from a utility that size with that number of customers depending on it for service. So those things are all documented now, and hopefully as we go forward, they will be addressed by the utility.
I'm really curious, though, Michael McDaniel, did the panel learn of justifications for these policies?
Well, we had quite a bit of debate about their policy on sensitive information. That is a policy that has been sort of compiled by the North America Electric Reliability Corporation, NERC, has these broad guidelines for all utilities. And that's based upon the Critical Infrastructure Act, which says certain information has to sort of be close held. However, I don't think that necessarily applies to all the information that we were talking about here, especially because that is the only instance, Mark, where BWL truly treated itself as an integral piece of critical infrastructure in the committee. They sort of took this policy and said, well, we're critical infrastructure. We have to follow this without doing all the other things to assure that they are an integrated system of critical infrastructure within the systems within the state within that are recognized by the Department of Homeland Security. So
there are always ways for local units of government or utilities to find their way around the disclosure of public information. You can get a pass on any number of things. But I think at the end of the day, if the information that is being sought does not fall within those categories, be it personnel-related issues, legal matters, then they have a duty to disclose.
How much did the lack of these kinds of records compromise your final report? Do you feel like the report is incomplete?
I don't know that it would have changed our recommendations at all. Certainly, I think we ended up spending more time as we went back and forth trying to find data. Yes. And certainly, I think that you see there are a couple of instances where we specifically say we don't have all the data that we wanted here, such as on the outage management system, such as on the events during the outage and then restoration itself, so that we had to make certain assumptions or we had to rely on other sources like the City of Lansing's emergency management logs. But I think that our report is complete.
Now, the report explicitly says that assessing the performance of individuals during the outage is up to others, the board, the City of Lansing, but you do assess the BWL leadership more broadly. The report mentions the current organizational structure. What could be improved there?
Well, this was an issue that we did discuss. I think from a broad general standpoint, the consensus was that the time has come for the governing authority of the BWL to consider its regional influence, its regional service now. Many of the communities have grown over the years since we've been a part of the system. And I think without saying specifically what the city or the BWL board should do, we recognize that there needs to be some discussion about a more regionalized representation on the board. And I think that was pointed up in this instance by the lack of communication from the BWL to the municipalities, as we said.
I would add, I absolutely agree with everything Darnell said, of course, but I would also add that we looked at the lack of direct reports to the general manager. It seemed to us that you had a period of at least 2 years in which the outage management system was sort of in development but was not fully implemented or deployed or usable. And if you're the CEO, you would think that the director of IT is a direct report and you are asking them on a weekly or monthly basis, worried about having an outage, how are we doing on this system? What's the update on the OMS? And so that having a layer or two between the director of IT and the general manager to us seemed to have perhaps, and again, you know, we didn't want to speculate, but there seemed to me that that was inconsistent with what any other corporate or governmental body would have done, and it seemed to me that could have been one of the issues. We didn't put that in the report because, of course, we'd be speculating, but there had to be more direct reports. Not having your operations manager, not having your IT directly report to your general manager, I think has to slow down the communication, particularly during an emergency event where you want clear and clean direct communication.
There's what appears to be limited optimism in the report regarding reforms, whether or not reforms can be achieved. Page 72, the BWL structure and culture make reform difficult, if not impossible, from within. Any comment there? Tell us more.
Well, I would say that with any institution that is as entrenched as this one, there is a culture there. There are traditions. There is a certain amount of isolation. There is a feeling that perhaps their only independence independence is owed to the board and no place else. And so those kind of things are difficult to change. But I'm confident that this report lays out a very good blueprint for reform. And I think the onus is going to be going forward now on the board and the leadership at the BWL to use this as a blueprint for reform. And we will be certainly expecting that.
We're trying to urge not just the senior leadership, but the Board of Commissioners of the board and the city to really push for changes there when we use that language. I mean, that was considered language. We did that intentionally. We can't have the Board of Water and Light saying, well, we're already doing these things, we're making these changes, let's move on. We really need, I think, for the community to again embrace the Board of Water and Light as its hometown power company and restore public confidence and trust in the BWL, for the Board of Water and Light to say, starting with the Board of Commissioners, to specifically say, we're going to take this report, we're going to take all 60 of these recommendations, here are the individuals within our organization who are going to go through these, and just as they did with their own outage report, focusing on the outage, look at these broader suggestions that we have made to sort of change, to truly reconfigure, to truly transform the Board of Water and Light, both in terms of the company structure, as we said, with the direct reports, but also this broader culture that doesn't look strategically at its role within the community and say, we're going to make these changes. So we were intentionally trying to push the Board of Water and Light board and senior leadership to say, yeah, we have to do this. Not that we've already done it or everything's fine.
You're listening to an extended segment here on WKAR's Current State. Our special guests are the chairman of the community review team investigating the Board of Water and Light's response to December's ice storm, General Michael McDaniel, and CRT member Darnell Early. You reported 3 days of no communication with Lansing city officials. Where did that breakdown occur?
Well, I think the system itself had not been ingrained from our review to require that on a regular basis. And if it's not required and it's not demanded, it's kind of business as usual. I think that's what we found. It was, for the most part, in my opinion, the way of doing business. And it was just pretty much emblematic of the way they've done business for years.
It's part of the culture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I think that it was very indicative. It's not just the fact that there was no communications for 3 days. It's indicative that they, as Darnell just said, they did not have a overarching comprehensive emergency operations plan in place to say, here is the official from BWL who is going to be in the EOC assisting in decision-making community-wide with city officials. It also has to do with they did not have sufficient management in place. When you increase your staff by 3 or 4 times in terms of the boots on the ground, when you bring in outside line workers and damage assessors through mutual aid and other agreements, you're increasing your staff. You need to increase your management. You need to increase your management because you're now working 24/7 on these. And then you've also got the fact that the outage management system wasn't working, and they had to reconstruct this. This is all following down on the electrical transmission and distribution section because they didn't have a way to, in place, a part of their plan to assist, you know, where the entire organization would assist that section. And you've got to have that flexibility, that agility in a plan which has not just been implemented, but on which they're trained and they've exercised, so that when that sort of contingency occurs, you can shift resources, including personnel, as necessary.
You focused on the Board of Water and Light in your report. Does the city bear greater responsibility than maybe we are aware of?
Well, we talk a little bit about some of the things that the city needs to do. We mentioned the fact that Delta Township, Shiawassee County, a couple of the other counties, but not Ingham County, not Lansing, not East Lansing, declared emergencies. So we talk about the idea of sort of a proactive declaration of an emergency, because that then frees up the mayor to reassign resources. Then secondly, we suggest the idea that maybe during emergencies, the mayor should have greater control over this city asset. I mean, if we've got personnel that are not reacting quickly enough, at some point, you know, command and control has to be a clear organization line upwards. At some point, it's going to come to the mayor, and perhaps we have to have a situation where the mayor can step in and say, okay, we need to reassign these employees to assist the Board of Water and Light, or move Board of Water and Light employees to assist other city public works agencies in some occasions. So we do make some suggestions directly to the city.
Looking at a timeline here, what is the community review team's most immediate recommendations? Are there reforms that really ought to be pursued post-haste?
The first thing I would suggest is that we say that the Board of Commissioners, the Board of Water and Light, should create a local government liaison committee. They need to have some form immediately, some form of representation and discussion with all the units of government within this area. And that should include a review of the community review team's report and consideration of that with the outage report. So I think that that's the first thing they need to do. Get representation. I'm not necessarily talking about board representation, because that is a longer process that has to be considered and given full and due consideration because of the issues involved there. But they have to have a local government team with representatives from all the local governments, and then together look at the recommendations that are in our report.
The idea there being, of course, that this report should be implemented. We believe that it cuts through the emotion, and these kind of situations do create a lot of emotion. It also cuts through the anger, the hurt, the pain, and the cries for vengeance against the BWL. Puts us in a position of putting before the decision makers a factual analysis of what happened based on the information. And I think the onus should now be on the leadership, that same leadership that that was not involved during the emergency, to call for those reforms and to use this report as a blueprint to get there. I think that's very important going forward. And I'm confident that if that happens, then these issues that we've outlined in our report are manageable. And being manageable, it means that they can emerge as a better utility, a better system. They can address some of the issues. And should something like this, God forbid, happen again, they'll be in a much better position to respond than they were in December. And I'm not convinced, nor is any member of the committee that I've talked to, that since December, of their own volition, they've corrected all of these issues. I mean, there are a lot of issues there, and there's still a lot of work to be done.
Who's responsible for making sure that all this hard work doesn't sit on a shelf and collect the proverbial dust?
Well, I think that's the role of the Board of Commissioners, the Board of Water and Light. They are appointed by the mayor as this oversight board, but I think also, I mean, they have the initial responsibility, but I think also it's us, the members of the community, as not just BWL customers, but think of ourselves as our responsibility as community members to assure that we have the change that we believe that we need, as evidenced in this report, and the change which the BWL senior leadership has said that they are committed to making. They say they want to be transformational and innovative. Well, to do that, I think they have to set up a committee that is going to publicly consider all of the 60 recommendations that we have in this report.
After getting a crash course on the complexities of running a utility and distributing power to the community, what do you make of it all? I mean, I'm especially interested, have we become too dependent on easy access to power whenever we need it?
Well, I think we've taken a lot for granted. And that's easy to do when you don't have issues like we had in December to respond to. But I think that, again, the issue of going forward is important. And I think that the BWL needs the assistance of everyone going forward in order to improve upon its service delivery system. There are a lot of moving parts in providing utilities, be they water, electricity, sewer, natural gas. There's a lot of work involved in that, and there's a lot of things to be considered. And sometimes you just don't know how prepared you are until something happens. So having had something happen, I'm confident that if implemented, this report will help them emerge as a better utility, will keep our dependence on their service at an expected level, nothing rising too high above their ability to provide that service. And I think everybody gets included in the discussions of how to improve and how to make the service delivery better. After all, it's a paid service. And as customers and as users of the, of the service, I think we ought to demand that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mark. Just remember how ugly things got last Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, that we are very dependent upon electric power in our society, more so than any other form of energy. We talk about, automobiles and gasoline, but we're more dependent on electrical power than any other form of energy, and we're more dependent on energy than any other system of critical infrastructure.
Do the public's expectations need to be tempered a bit, though?
No, I think that what needs to be educated to the public is that we have to have many other alternative forms of energy. So we're not totally reliant on electrical power. We're not totally relying on electrical power from coal. Board of Water and Light has made a couple great steps in this area with its natural gas plant, with the power that it buys from Granger, from the waste-to-energy plant. There is more that needs to be done in this area for alternative forms of energy, and we need to look more at energy reduction. We all still have air conditioners that we want to run in the summer, and, you know, it's amazing how many people went out and bought generators immediately. I'm not saying that's not a good thing, because from an emergency management standpoint, it is a good thing, but it's reaffirms our reliance on electrical power, that we're going to look for another source, including gasoline-driven electrical power.
Darnell, how does it feel to be getting your evenings and weekends back?
Well, it's important to me because in my day job, I have my hands full there as well.
Everybody has other responsibilities on the CRT. That's worth reminding people of.
Well, but this was a good work. I think it was the work that needed to take place. It takes a snapshot in time and the history of the Board of Water and Light, and hopefully it sparks some very productive discussion about going forward. Again, I think it's time to move forward now. Our report is issued. We took all of the testimony, and we've heard from everyone who wanted to be a part of the discussion. Our report speaks for itself, and I think going forward, as I've said and will continue to say, that the BWL can emerge as a much stronger public utility as a result of this work, in addition to the work that they've already done.
Michael, is your work done?
Oh, absolutely not. I would just point out that, as Darnell said earlier, when we say moving forward, we're not saying that this was a cathartic event and that we now just move on. What we're saying is you have to take this report as a blueprint and consider this. Some of the things that we have in this report are sort of broad strokes and need to be developed further by the region, like the idea of a regional emergency operations plan and emergency operations center, by the city in terms of looking at the role of the Board of Water and Light, by the board itself and looking at its role for oversight and supervision of both the long-term strategy and the agenda of the Board of Water and Light, including looking at this report, by the Public Service Commission taking this report and comparing it with the others that they have already, and then, of course, by the senior leadership of the Board of Water and Light themselves to fully and publicly consider all of the recommendations that we put here, not just to say we're already doing that, but to say that's a good idea. Here is starting that public debate. For example, smart meters starting on the lateral circuits, those folks who are off on a short service line, so that they were sort of realized or recognized or identified late in the process that they had an outage of power. You know, we have to look at where we're going to place smart meters, and we have to look at the cost of smart meters and make a decision as to whether that's most effective. The idea of the breakaway service drops instead of fixing customer service masts, is that more cost effective, and can the BWL be doing that immediately? Those sort of issues need to be publicly debated, and that needs to be done right away. And back to your other question, I just wanted to say that I'm absolutely grateful to the Cooley Law School for allowing me to take so much time over the last term to work on this. I know it was to the detriment, I think, of my students last term, and I hope I make it up to them.
General Michael McDaniel has been the chairman of Lansing's Community Review Team. Darnell Early is a member of that team as well. For the past 4 months, he's the current emergency financial manager for the city of Flint. Many thanks to both of you, and best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
its current state here on 90.5 WKAR. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality proposed new rules in late April to regulate hydraulic fracturing in Michigan, or fracking. The new regulations focus on monitoring high-volume fracking operations for water quality and supplying more information to the public. James Clift is policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. He says the new regulations are a step in the right direction. However, there are some flaws with the proposed changes. And James joins us now to break down the new regulations. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
The new fracking regulations focus on high-volume operations. What constitutes a high-volume fracking operation?
Yeah, they use 100,000 gallons of water that they inject into the well under high pressure with sand and chemicals to kind of free up the natural gas. So that's the threshold there.
Okay. And how many of these high-volume fracking operations are currently operating in Michigan?
We only have a dozen or two currently in operation. Part of that is the relatively low price of natural gas today. So if we were to see that increase, we think we'd see a lot more of these wells coming to Michigan.
Okay. Are there many parties or companies in the process of applying for permits?
You know, currently they're kind of trickling in, and some of that's based on that current price of natural gas. So what we're seeing is some very large companies in Michigan, and they're kind of poking around the edges, doing some testing. I think for that day where the price might go up, and then you would see them bring all of their operations into Michigan. You might see hundreds of wells very quickly if that price of natural gas goes up.
One of the new regulations requires baseline water testing for these high-volume operations. What will baseline testing tell us about fracking?
What you're trying to do there is establish, you know, what was the condition of water when they got there? Just in case there's a problem with the well or a spill, there'll be no argument of, was that there beforehand? So what we're trying to do is kind of say, okay, what was the conditions then? The big question I'm hearing around the state, because, you know, a lot of the oil and gas operations we're seeing today are moving into southern Lower Peninsula, usually looking for oil. I've been in town halls in Scio Township outside of Ann Arbor, Rochester Hills last night, and these folks are kind of asking the same question. Why don't these rules apply to us for traditional oil and gas? Why doesn't everybody have to do this baseline testing before they drill any well in Michigan?
What do you make of that argument?
I think it's a good argument. I mean, you know, it's kind of interesting in that we're having these oil and gas operations move into very kind of settled areas. They're trying to lease underneath subdivisions in Rochester Hills. These people are very concerned about their water quality, and I think they've got a legitimate concern in this area.
And what about the smaller fracking operations? Are they exempt from these proposed regulations?
They are. And, you know, the classic one there was the Antrim Formation in northern Michigan, had about 4,000 wells drilled during the 90s. A lot of those have already been fracked, but those usually used less than 100,000. But, again, I think some of the same concerns apply in those circumstances.
Now, the new fracking rules would also require the full disclosure of the volumes and the types of chemicals used during the fracking process. What kinds of chemicals are typically used in fracking?
Got a number of chemicals there, and usually what we're trying to do is they're trying to loosen up the natural gas, so sometimes it's kind of some different acids, hydrochloric acids and other, to kind of break it up. Then some things to make it slipperier so that they can kind of slide out. So a variety of chemicals that are used as lubricants. They also include sand in there so that when they kind of under the fracking operations, they kind of blast a fracture into the rocks. That's where the name comes from. Then the sand keeps it open so the natural gas can come out. So a variety of chemicals. You'll see a dozen, two dozen chemicals listed in some of these sites.
And, well, the sand is obviously found in nature, but the lubricants and the hydrochloric acids, probably not.
I would guess.
I mean, how potentially destructive are these chemicals to the environment?
Well, the key here is that on these large volume ones, I said the threshold was 100,000 gallons. We have up to 21 million gallons of fluid being used in some of these wells today. So it's a lot of material. So even though the chemicals are only maybe 1%, that's 50, 100,000 gallons of these different chemicals that might be mixed with that 20 million gallons of water and injected into these wells. So our concern is that's a lot of chemical. Then some of that water comes back to the surface during the drilling operation, making sure that fluid is properly captured. And either treated or re-injected into the ground and not to get to our fresh water. That's the key, is how to keep it out of our fresh water, how to keep it away from the public so they're not exposed to it.
Now, we're talking with James Clift of the Michigan Environmental Council about proposed DEQ regulations regarding fracking in Michigan. Although the regulations would require the disclosure of chemicals, this is very interesting. They have a broad timeline to disclose that information. When would operations have to post the chemicals they use?
Yeah, so it's 30 days after drilling. So this is an industry that really is just cloaked in secrecy. And maybe that's from the original, you know, back in the 20s and 30s where, you know, this was kind of the wildcat operation where you didn't want your competitor to know you, where you were. So they're actually exempted from a wide variety of laws, and they're not required to tell anybody until kind of after the fact. Well, in today's society, Google Earth, all their competitors know exactly where they are. So a lot of these exemptions from laws and the secrecy that I think cloaks the industry, I think all these regulations need to be revised. The public deserves this information before the drilling starts, so that if they want to do their own baseline testing, they know what to look for, they know what types of chemicals the company might be using on their property.
Michigan, we should point out, Michigan has a pretty respectable record on fracking safety. How relevant is that?
That is relevant. I mean, we've up till now have done a pretty good job in protecting our freshwater resources. I think we look at the fact that these operations continue to grow in scope. You know, they used to be 100,000 gallons just a decade ago, and now we're talking 21 million gallons of water being used. So our question is, have the regulations kept up with the growth of the size of the operations and the risk they pose to Michigan's natural resources? We don't think they have. We think they're trying. This is a step in the right direction. But in a number of areas, we think they have to review the exemptions these operations currently have from law and bring them into the fold of being regulated like any other industrial operation in the state.
We'll point out also that the DEQ will be asking for public feedback regarding the proposed fracking rules for the summer. We want to thank our guest. James Clift is Policy Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
And this segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. It's not that often that individuals from the Lansing area can claim to have had an impact around the world, but our next two guests are members of that fraternity. Thanks to them, runners everywhere have been able to prevent injuries. Kurt Munson and John Benedict are fixtures in the mid-Michigan running community. Munson took over a Playmakers apparel and footwear back in 1977. More recently, he and co-owner John Benedict began exploring a challenge that every runner has faced: injuries, and more to the point, how to prevent them. Several years of study led to a preventative technique that's gradually spread around the world: good form running. Its mantra: run light, run easy. Joining us to explain how good form running came on the scene and has evolved, two of the four co-owners of Playmakers in Okemos, Kurt Munson and John Benedict. Welcome.
Thanks, Mark.
Nice to be here.
Good form running dates back to what year exactly, Kurt?
It's been going for 8 years now.
Okay. And how did the technique itself unfold?
It just unfolded over time. I mean, we asked questions many years ago, and it took quite a while, but for me, back in 1984, I had a customer ask how Arthur Leader, a famous coach out of New Zealand, could have his runners run 100 miles a week, week after week, and not get injured. And I didn't want to run 100 miles a week, but I did want to avoid injuries since I was injured. So started thinking about that. He came over to the country on a number of occasions, inspired us. He was voted the coach of the century this, you know, recently. And that's kind of what got me started. And over time, I kept reading articles and seeing other techniques, and then, you know, I approached John 8 years ago on what I thought, and he jumped right on board because John was a Mittelrinken champ at Central Michigan, but hadn't run for 10 years because he was all banged up. And so that's, and so John and then Grant Robison is the other person that.
Tell our listeners who Grant Robison is here. Here's a guy with some credentials.
Sure. Grant was a 10-time All-American at Stanford, a national champ, but always injured. Didn't have a year. He wasn't injured. And he came to Playmakers, applied for a job, didn't have much availability, but then we thought, you know, you could jump in and teach with us. And so he started right from the get-go. And he's been doing it ever since, and he hasn't been injured for 8 years now. Hmm.
John, when did you know you were on to something new here?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, having run, you know, for all of my life, I didn't think there was a way to get back running, and Kurt was really on to me about this technique, and I had just been injured, Mark, and so I couldn't run, and he said, why don't you try running this way, which is the way that eventually turned into good form, and all of a sudden, 2 weeks after I was injured, I was able to run without pain, which is just, you know, shocking to me. Mm-hmm. And that's when I knew it's like, wow, it's really worked good for Kurt. It's amazing for me. This is a big deal. It's something that we need to tell people about.
How did you launch Good Form Running?
Well, once we figured it out, you know, we collaborated, we had meetings every week, we met and we talked about how do we do this? And we looked at other forms. There were people that were teaching other classes, but our ultimate goal was to make it simple and free. And that was the goal, and that's still the goal, to provide that and get it out to the masses. So that's where it started. And it was just a work in progress, and didn't know how long it would last. Thought maybe we'll go through people in 6 months. It just kept building year in and year out after.
We're talking with Kurt Munson and John Benedict of Playmakers in Okemos about Good Form Running, which originated here in Okemos at Playmakers. The shoemaker New Balance was obviously impressed and has been quite a force in spreading Good Form Running. Talk to us about the New Balance.
So yeah, New Balance heard about what we were doing, and we were at the time showing other stores how to do this, and other stores were having success, and that really got us fired up because other stores, friends of ours around the country, were teaching Good Form Running, and New Balance heard about it and said, let's jump on board with this thing. And so they have taken it, established a program that to help stores teach it, so and keep it free, like Kurt said, and so that's where the spread came from, as well as overseas, because they're sold all around the world. So that took it out there.
How hard is it to adopt Good Form Running for someone who's been running a long time? Is it a technique that's hard to learn?
I'm not sure it's so hard to learn as much as it. You really, we've been programmed no matter what we do. If we have a certain golf swing or,
sure.
And to change that takes time and patience. But some people it comes really quick, and other people, you know, might be a year later and it's like, oh, I got it. You know, so it's not that complicated, but it's yeah.
Run light, run easy. Tell us a little bit more about how that actually unfolds for a runner, John.
Well, I'll tell you what, most people, they overstride, Mark. They land in front of themselves. It creates a lot of shock. It's sort of a heaviness to it.
They overstride. Their steps are too long.
They're too long, okay. And they're landing in front of their center of gravity, and that creates sort of a braking forces. And you always hear about these negative impacts of running, which are true if you run that way. And we find almost everyone does. We're trying to teach people to run lighter, smoother, and take out those braking forces, so it's just a more of a flow, and it's very possible and not really difficult to learn once you get the concept. We're born to run that way. We just learn bad habits when we put shoes on our feet.
And shorter steps.
Little shorter steps,
okay.
Absolutely.
Shorter steps, run lighter, run easier. Is there a kind of injury that Good Form Running specifically helps to prevent?
Well, I think there are a variety of injuries. For me, it was my knees. For John, it was calf and Achilles. But the reality is when you overstride and create that braking and friction, it for a lot of people, it finds your weak link. And it's just when you learn to, what I'd say, we want to try to glide rather than overstride and take that braking and friction away. And you can notice it even on, you know, we sell shoes, and your shoes will last a lot longer when you run properly. And but more importantly, your body will be last a lot longer also. So,
if you're a competitive runner, it seems as if the harder you push, the easier it would be to forget to run light and run easy. You're exerting yourself. You're pushing yourself, and you're not thinking light and easy if you're really pushing and exerting yourself. Is that a challenge for runners who are really eager to get faster?
So I think if you talk, Mark, to the best runners in the world, you would find that they actually practice on running fast and relaxed at the same time. We associate, you know, like a big effort with like maybe tension, but it's not that way at all. It's really absence of that. You want to relax to run faster. And so the best runners know that, and they work on that. So this is something that's very well established in the high end, you know, that performance competitive running area. It's in fact, the general average slow runners like me are the ones that aren't relaxing enough when they run.
How do you define slow exactly, John?
You know,
what
pretty
I would like
old
to know.
And slow. I'm probably nine.
It's all relative.
9 minute pace mile guy. That's where I'm at. Yeah.
And you do hold clinics on good form. Free clinics on good
Correct.
Form running
yeah.
at Playmakers. There is a Playmakers Foundation as well. What's mm-hmm. your focus, Kurt?
Well, the focus foundation was to help people move more and move better, and so it's really tied to good form. And we've had the benefit of having one of our former employees come on board with us, and she's taken the foundation. It's one thing to have a foundation, but she's really taken it out, and it's for running, walking, and just moving in general.
Why did you start a foundation?
We started the foundation because we just really felt it was real important to get this out, and so the best way to do that would be to start a foundation. And it's been going for, you know, really we've had it for a while, but really been going for a little over a year thanks to Marcy Kinzer and her team.
I think we wanted longevity with that foundation. You know, wanted to do something that this is so important, it's not going to go away. And this really ensures that we'll be teaching kids and all the way through. We'll be working with the AARP as well. Everybody in between, and the foundation's just really focused on it. So it's really been a nice thing.
Were you involved in the Lansing Marathon? You're heavily involved in a lot of races. Were you involved in this past weekend's marathon?
Yeah, our group was out there. We're involved with most every race in the area. So they were out there with the truck and providing support. So we do that with a variety of races.
What do you guys make of the fact that Lansing has a marathon at all?
I think it's great that we have a marathon. You know, I think Kurt's point is like the more events you have done well, the better chance for runners, walkers to get out there. And that's really what we're all about.
Okay. Very good. We want to thank both of our guests here talking all about preventing injuries in running. Kurt Munson and John Benedict are two of the four co-owners of Playmakers in Okemos. And again, they hold free good form running clinics at the store.
And walking.
And good form walking as well. We will mention that as well. Kurt, John, thanks an awful lot. Best of luck.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, we'll discuss Bridge Magazine's Citizen Survey, and we learn more about the reopening of the Owosso Theater. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our program's producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and to Kevin Lavery, to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.